a pleasure to welcome Dr. Walfisch, who we had many years ago. We hosted him over a Shabbat live in Toronto. And as I mentioned earlier, I don't know if it was mentioned last week, I consider you the inventor of the literary analysis of the Mishnah, what Har Etzion in many ways did in Tanakh, the literary analysis I think you're doing to the Mishnah. And as you know, I'm a big fan of this whole system. It's wonderful. I love learning Mishnah. I think you learn Mishnah, you learn Kol HaTorah Kula. Gemara is good. You go back and forth. But at the end of the day, you don't get the knowledge and the breadth of knowledge you get from learning the Mishnah. And I really want to thank Dr. Walfisch for his pioneering work in so much. He did his PhD on a literary analysis on Mishnah Rosh Hashanah. And I guess this four-part series is a little bit a synopsis of this 500-page PhD, which you can read. I don't think it's been translated into English yet, but okay. Vakashat, Dr. Walfisch, will be doing Perek Beit today in Mishnah Rosh Hashanah. Im ein makirin oto, meshalchim acher lahaido, I believe is how it begins. Okay.
That's right. That's how it begins. And just if you could give me a share screen.
Yes, I'm doing that right now. Okay. So you can share your screen. Okay, Vakasha.
Okay, very good. So we'll actually start with a bit of review just to get us on the same page. If we look at chapter one, okay, I'm giving you the breakdown of chapter one as we studied it last week. The main feature of chapter one that we focused on was the move from shanim to chodashim, okay, from years to months. Okay, the first two mishnayot talking about how to divide up the year. The rest of the chapter, and as we'll see, all of today's chapter is all about kiddush hachodesh, sanctification of the new moon. So this move back and forth, which we'll see continuing on as we go through the Masechet, that's what we really focused on trying to understand last time. There were a lot of other points that we made along the way, but I'll just note one or two of the highlights, and then we'll jump right into chapter two. We noted how Mishnah Gimel is a transitional Mishnah. It's a segue from years to months, al shisha chodashim ashluchim yotzim. What makes it a segue is that it's the last Mishnah until the third chapter to mention Rosh Hashanah. So we have three Mishnayot that mention Rosh Hashanah, but in the first two Mishnayot, Rosh Hashanah is, first of all, the beginning of a unit of time, which is what its name sounds like, but it's one of four. The second Mishnah, it's upgraded to be the one and only Rosh Hashanah, but here it functions as a festival, which, like other festivals in Mishnah Bet, serve as times of judgment. Both the measurement of a year and the theme of judgment on festivals basically are talking about divine time, okay? Time divided up the way God divides it, a year is something that exists in nature. It's part of creation. Okay. And so you have the natural divisions in Mishnah Aleph. You have the times, the special times of judgment that correspond mostly to special events in nature in Mishnah Bet. Okay. Months, on the other hand, are a human event, a cultural event. Okay. And as we go through chapter one, and even more, as we'll see in a couple of minutes in chapter two, okay, we see how the whole society galvanizes in order to establish when the month begins. So that's the move from Mishnah Aleph Bet about years to months. Okay, but in talking about months, not only does the Mishnah use the term Rosh Hashanah, but actually, Rosh Hashanah plays a dual role in Mishnah Gimel. On the one hand, we send out messengers to notify the people when the new moon was sanctified for Elul, because of Rosh Hashanah approximately 29 days later. That's treating Rosh Hashanah as a festival. People want to know, when do I observe Rosh Hashanah? But then the very next item on the list is Al Tishrei Mipnei Takanat HaMoadot. We also send out messengers for Tishrei, meaning for Rosh Hashanah. After Rosh Hashanah was established as Rosh Hashanah, we send out. Why? Not because of Rosh Hashanah. We celebrated it already, but rather because of Takanat HaMoadot, because of Yom Kippur and Sukkot that will occur later in the month. Okay, and so in this Mishnah, Rosh Hashanah, which is the segue, is operating on both levels. First, it's operating as a Rosh Hashanah, as a festival, as a special day. Okay, so that links it up with the previous two Mishnayot. And then we look at that very same date as the beginning of a month. Rosh Hashanah is also the beginning of the month of Tishrei. And that's why we send out Shluchim for that month as well. Okay, so this Mishnah really sort of encapsulizes the move from years to months, and we talked somewhat about the meaning of that last time. Okay, one final point before we dive into chapter 2 is the main theme that the Mishnah talks about, starting from Mishnah Dalet. Okay, and this frames the whole unit, is Chilul Shabbat. The very first thing we want to talk about after Mishnah Gimel, which is, you know, sort of out of order in a way, we'll get back to that later. The main theme, starting with Mishnah Dalet, is Chilul Shabbat. And we closed last time with the thought that the reason why we are Mechalel Shabbat for two special months, Nisan and Tishrei, are the months of Tikkun HaMoadot. The reason we do that is because the Moadot are times of judgment, which makes them on a spiritual plane a kind of Pikuach Nefesh, a communal Pikuach Nefesh. And because of this communal Pikuach Nefesh, in order to ensure that we stand before God in judgment in the best possible way, to prepare for it in the best possible way, we have to establish the new month, therefore the festival, on the right day. In order to do that, we even override Shabbat. Shabbat, which is the one festival, the one holy day that does not require human involvement. Okay? It's just a series of 7 days, 7 days, 7 days, all the way back to creation. So that day of Shabbat, the divine holy day, we override in order for us to establish the humanly established holy days at the right time, which we would assume means the time determined astronomically. Okay? The witnesses are the ones who can tell us what the reality was up in the heavens, and we want to make sure we get it right. Make sure we get it right. We even override the laws of Shabbat, which shows us how seriously we take this. Okay, now Let's get a handle on.
I think there's a question first.
Okay. Yes.
I wanted to ask about Mila. After you have Uvayom Hashmini with reference to Brit Mila, Uvayom Hashmini Afilu B'Shabbat. It seems to be a similar idea that the set time overrides Shabbat.
That's correct. Bayom Hashmini functions like B'Moadam. And I think if we're looking at it not just from a midrashic standpoint of, you know, how we derive it from the psukim, but from a conceptual standpoint, I think we can readily see why Brit Milah on the eighth day is also such a central feature of Jewish identity that it can override Shabbat. So festivals are like Brit Milah in that regard. Okay, they become a really central part of what it means to be Jewish, or perhaps what it means to be a Jewish people. Okay, and that's why we can even violate Shabbat. Okay, let's now take a look at Yeah, let's take a look at the text. Okay, so we want our Al HaTorah.
Also. To violate Shabbat for the Omer, for this Minchat Ta'omer.
Excuse me, I missed that.
Minchat Ta'omer also is going to violate Shabbat in order
right,
to.
All, right, all korbanot that have fixed time.
That's a public korban, that's my point.
Now, okay, well, okay, the Mishnah on Tmura actually clarifies that it's not because it's public, but rather because it has a fixed time. Usually is a correlation between the two of them, but not always. Okay, so let's now take a look. We'll do a quick survey of this chapter. So here, let's get on the screen. There is it. Why is Zoom not presenting this on the screen? Where is the text of the Mishnah? Okay, Zoom, I'll show all windows. Here we go. Show all windows. Here we go. There we've got it. Okay, here we go. Okay, so the first Mishnah, okay, just for the quick read through, I'm not going to read through the whole thing, okay, and I'll deal a lot with the English translation just to save time. If the members of the Sanhedrin are not familiar with the one who saw the new moon, then we send another one with him to testify about him. This continues some important themes from chapter one. Okay, one of the themes is we send him. In other words, the witness doesn't go by himself. Before the witness journeys to Yerushalayim in order to testify, before he does that, he first appears before his local rabbinic authorities, a local Beit Din. And the local Beit Din then sends him and provides him with whatever he needs to have a safe and successful journey. We saw that already in chapter one. And we're continuing with that now. We send with him, in other words, the local court sends with him a character witness because we're afraid his testimony won't be accepted. And then the Mishnah continues with the background. Initially, the court would accept testimony from any person. However, the language of the Mishnah is minim, the translator translated as Boethusians, okay, Baitusim in Hebrew, and scholars have determined based on manuscripts that originally it was called Beitsin. There's a lot of speculation who exactly they were, but it's some kind of heretical sect. There were a lot of heretical sects floating around at the time of the Second Temple, and we are here in Second Temple times when the High Court is still sitting in Yerushalayim. Okay, so when the Minim tried to disrupt the procedure by sending false witnesses, an incident of this nature is described in the Tosefta, and the Talmud discusses it. Then Hitkinu Shloyu Mekablim Elam Min HaMakirim. Then it was instituted. We will circumvent this problem by insisting that we will accept testimony only from witnesses we know and know that we can trust. If we don't know them, we need character witnesses who we do know who will attest to their veracity. Okay. Barishona, next Mishnah. Initially, after the court sanctified the new month, they would like torches or beacons to signal that the month was sanctified. And here it's Misha Kilkalu HaKutim. Itkinu Shiyu Shluchin Yotzin. Okay, now it's the Samaritans, the Kutim, who are trying to disrupt the procedure, presumably by sending up beacons on the wrong night. Okay, so people are being misled. Okay, so once that happened, so we again circumvented that by instituting that we won't light beacons anymore. We'll send out messengers. Now, what's the advantage of beacons? So the obvious answer is it's a lot faster. Okay? Travels at the speed of light, right? And then as long as it takes for the person on the next mountaintop to light his beacon. Okay? But basically, you know, within a matter of a very short period of time, the message has gone as far as you want it to go, whereas messengers take some time to travel. And in those days, it would take quite a long time. That's why in Chutz La'aretz, people celebrate 2 days of Yom Tov, because the messengers didn't reach there in time. So they were never sure when the court had actually sanctified the new moon. So there is an advantage to the beacons, but since there was also this very serious problem of the Samaritans trying to disrupt the transmission, so we circumvent it by sending out the more unwieldy and much less efficient messengers. Okay? Much less efficient, but more reliable messengers would be sent out. Now, the immediate question we should be raising here is, what is this Mishnah doing here? Okay? We've jumped from the beginning of the process, how we go about sending out the witnesses, we've jumped to the end of the process. Okay? Why have we done that? It's sort of reminiscent of what we did in the first chapter, where we started the whole discussion of Kiddush HaChodesh with the messengers, and then jumped to the witnesses, whereas we would have expected to start with the witnesses. It wasn't clear why we start with the messengers, and we spent a lot of time analyzing that, including, you know, what we just finished saying now about how the mission of the messengers is a segue, okay, between the two main parts of the chapter. So that gives us some insight into why it's ordered in that way. But here, again, we're jumping, and in this case, we're jumping back from the beginning of the procedure of how to send the witnesses. We're jumping to the end of the process of, do we send out beacons? Do we send out messengers? Why is the Mishnah doing that? Okay, that's a serious question. Let's note it, and we will come back to it. But what compounds the question is that the Mishnah doesn't just immediately return to the main topic. That will happen another 3 Mishnayot hence. First, we have 2 additional Mishnayot to continue the detour. Okay? How would they light the torches? And then they describe how exactly they would do it, and how they would light it on one mountaintop and, you know, raise it up and lower it back and forth until he sees that the next mountaintop is doing the same thing. And they would continue doing so on the 3rd mountain, okay? And then in Mishnah Dalid, and from which mountains? In here we're given the geography, from Har HaZeitim in Yerushalayim to Sartava. Anyone who drives up through Bikat HaYarden will know about Sartava, a very prominent mountain peak in the Jordan Valley. Okay, so we get some idea of what the route looks like, and then it continues going north and then east. Okay, and when it gets to a place called Beit Baltin, they would not move, okay, but rather would keep on waving the torch up and down, back and forth, till he would see the entire diaspora before him alight like one large bonfire. In other words, it's going all the way to Iraq, okay, going all the way to Persia. Okay, That's how far it's traveling. And again, within a matter of maybe an hour or two at most, okay, the message has arrived. And this ends our digression. And now we return to the main topic. There was a large courtyard in Yerushalayim called Beit Ya'azek. And there all the witnesses would gather, and the court would examine them. It would prepare great feasts for them so that they would be accustomed to coming, okay? So they have them in this courtyard, and since they want to encourage people to come forward with their testimony, so they would make a big kiddush for them. And I say kiddush advisedly, because as we're about to see, the Mishnah has not yet abandoned the main framework of the whole discussion of testimony, which is this is all happening on Shabbat. How do I know that? Take a look at the next Mishnah, at the continuation of this Mishnah, the second half. Initially, they would not move from there all day. Okay, and here the translator adds, as they had left their Shabbat limit, it was consequently prohibited for them to walk more than 4 cubits in any direction. We jump back to Mishnah Aleph, when it says, Mishalchin Acher Imo La'ido, we send character witnesses, that's even on Shabbat. Because that's part of our Chilul Shabbat. Okay? That's implicit in the Mishnah, in the Tosefta, which is a collection of external Mishnayot, Mishnayot that were not included in the canon. Okay? And it's a collection of Baraitot, external Mishnayot, arranged more or less in the order of the Mishnah. The Tosefta says it explicitly. Yes, I see Ada has a question. Yes, no? Okay, we'll continue. Okay, so now we've returned to our main topic. We're back to Edim traveling on Shabbat, and we're saying that when the Edim travel on Shabbat, so then they come to this Beit Ya'azek and they give their testimony, and then they're stuck there. They can't move. Because that's one of the laws of person who has violated Shabbat by going beyond his tchum. But then, Hitkin Rabban Gamliel Azakein, that the witnesses be permitted to walk 2,000 cubits in each direction. Okay, in other words, again, it's clear to us that he wants to encourage them to come. If they're going to be stuck there all day, I know, you know, that this is a shaila that rabbis encounter very often. Okay. Someone who takes ill or suffers some kind of injury, and it's a toss-up whether there's any real pikuach nefesh should you travel to the hospital. And one of the considerations is, okay, will I be able to go home once I'm finished at the hospital? And if they can't go home, so some of them will hesitate whether to go, and there's a big debate in rabbinic circles and among poskim, whether that's a sufficient reason to allow them to return home. Okay? So here you see Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, at least when it comes to Tchum Shabbat, saying, yes, I'm going to take that very much into account and give them that dispensation because I don't want them to hesitate before coming. I want them to be sure they can come. Below Zobilvad, and the Mishnah again digresses, but in a very different direction. This same institution of Rabban Gamliel HaZaken applies not only to witnesses, but to a midwife who comes to deliver a child, the one who comes to rescue Jews from a fire, from an invasion of Gentile troops, from a flooding river, from a collapse of a building. Why in all of those cases would we allow the person who went beyond the Tchum Shabbat, violated Shabbat, why would we allow the person, once the mission is accomplished, to return, okay, to go outside of, you know, to return to his normal place? Why would we allow that? What characterizes all of these cases? They're all?
To save a life.
To save a life. They're all pikuach nefesh. And remember, we argued last week and at the beginning of today's shiur, we argued that sanctifying the new moon is a kind of communal pikuach nefesh. I think the Mishnah seems to be underscoring that here. And maybe that's why this digression is here. The digression is here to teach us that it's just as important for the community, for the witnesses to be going, as it is for the individual, okay, or for a smaller community, okay, to preserve their lives. In the same way you violate Shabbat to preserve lives, you violate Shabbat for the witnesses to go. And therefore, the same dispensation about Tchum Shabbat will apply in both cases. Okay, Mishnah continues, describing how do they examine the witnesses, and we have a whole description of how the witnesses are examined, including, just look briefly at the end of the Mishnah, and the court asks all the other pairs of witnesses certain general matters, not because they require the additional testimony, but so that the witnesses should not leave disappointed, so that they should be accustomed to coming to testify. Because if they made this effort and then the court doesn't even interrogate them, they won't come the next time. So we want to be sure they come. So we pretend that we need them, even though we really don't. And now we've moved now till the witnesses arrived at the court. The court now interrogated them. After interrogating them, the court decided their testimony is reliable. And now Mishnah Zayin brings this to a culmination. Okay. Rosh Beit Din Omer Mekudash V'chol Ha'amonim Acharav Mekudash Mekudash. There's a two-stage process of actually sanctifying it. First, the head of the court proclaims it is sanctified. In other words, he ratifies, I and my court have determined, we accept the witnesses, we accept the testimony, we therefore sanctify the new month. But then, interestingly, that's not the end of the process. The end is the people then confirm it by saying Mikudash, Mikudash. How crucial is this confirmation by the people? Question, we won't answer it right away. We will have something to say about it as we go on. Then the Mishnah has a very interesting comment to make. Ben shenirah bizmano, ben shelo nirah bizmano, mikadshin oto. All of this is when the moon was sighted on the night of the 30th. Remember, a lunar month is 29 and a half days, which means generally it will alternate between a 29-day month and the 30th day is Rosh Chodesh, and a 30-day month and the 31st is Rosh Chodesh. So if the new moon is not sighted on the night of the 30th, so all day, the whole 30th day went by, no witnesses showed up. What do we know? We know for a fact the next day will be Rosh Chodesh. There is no such thing as a 31-day month in our, you know, in our secular calendar today, in our Gregorian calendar today, that we have that. We have 31-day months. That's because it's not really a lunar calendar. But in a real lunar calendar, it's either the 30th or the 31st being the new month. So now, regardless of whether the moon was sighted at its time, meaning the 30th, or not cited at its time, or not cited on the 30th, the court will have to proclaim it to be sacred. The court will have to say Mikudash, and the people have to answer Mikudash, Mikudash. Even though there's no need for witnesses. If we reach the 31st day, you don't need witnesses. We know that this is the new month. But the court has to proclaim it. But Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Tzadok argues, the court in that case does not, because heaven already sanctified it. And I think this is a very interesting formulation. Okay. And it already seems to point to a theme that will be very crucial in our discussion. Who sanctifies the new month, God or man? So Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Tzadok says, well, on the 30th day, you need men to proclaim the new month. But on the 31st day, heaven sanctified it. You don't need the court at all. Court can take a day off because that day is sanctified with or without any proclamation of the court. Okay, the next Mishnah describes something about how Rabban Gamliel used to interrogate the witnesses. And we can again puzzle over how the Mishnah is jumping back and forth. We already finished the process. We already accepted the testimony. We already proclaim the new month, and all of a sudden we're back to Rabban Gamliel, how he interrogated the witnesses before accepting them. And why is that here? So the Mishnah again seems to be jumping back and forth. Okay? And then later in the Mishnah, we have a story. Sometimes the Mishnah tells us stories. Sometimes the stories seem to be purely halachic. And that seems to be the case in this first story. But then we'll see another story, a very famous story, that has some very important halachic points to make, but definitely has a lot more to offer than just pure and straight halacha. So one time, okay, There was an incident when two witnesses came and said, we saw the moon at its anticipated time, the 30th, but the following, above that, not the second paragraph, but already, still in the first paragraph. We saw the new moon in the morning in the east, and in the evening we saw it in the west. That can't happen. Okay, the moon, the new moon doesn't travel from east to west that quickly. Mm-hmm. And so Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri said they're false witnesses. They're describing something impossible. But when they arrived in Yavne, Rabban Gamliel accepted them. And we don't know why. The Mishnah doesn't bother explaining why. The Mishnah gives us a certain sense. Rabban Gamliel doesn't feel a need to explain himself. Or maybe the Mishnah doesn't feel the need to explain Rabban Gamliel. And we're sort of left scratching our heads. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri seems to be right. How does Rabban Gamliel accept them? Not clear to us. But then this is the backdrop for another very well-known story. There's another incident in which two witnesses came and said, saw the moon at its anticipated time, but on the following night, it was not seen. Very important question that I don't think we'll have time to deal with tonight. By whom was it not seen? Is this the witnesses talking, meaning they came a day late? In which case, who cares about their testimony? It's too late already. Or does it mean that the court had already sanctified the new moon because they accepted the witnesses? And then shortly after sanctifying the new moon, okay, it was nightfall and the judges all went out and said, hey, where's this new moon? There's a new moon. We should be seeing it tonight as well. Why can't we see it? Obviously, there's something wrong. Okay. And so Rabban Gamliel nevertheless accepted their testimony once again. And once again, we wonder, what is with this guy? How can he accept testimony that is patently false or self-contradictory? What's he doing? Okay. Nevertheless, he does it. But here we don't have to raise the question because the Mishnah quotes a sage who raised the question for us. Those of Enharkinos disagreed and said, there are false witnesses. How can witnesses testify that a woman gave birth, the next day her belly is between her teeth? Okay, very powerful question, and I would add a very powerful image, and I think a very suggestive image, but we can't get into that just yet. We will come back to that. And Rabbi Yoshua then said to him, I see the logic of your statement. Okay, roeh ani et varecha. But it's not just, the translation here is a bit faulty. Roeh ani et varecha doesn't just mean I see the logic. It means I accept your statement. Okay, it means Rabbi Yeshua rules like Rabbi Dosa ben Harkinos. And that will explain why shalach lo Rabban Gamliel to whom? To Rabbi Yehoshua. Now notice he does not send any messengers to Rabbi Dosa ben Harkinos. We'll come back to that point in a minute. He said, Rabban Gamliel sends to Rabbi Yoshua, okay? He says, I decree against you that you must appear before me with your staff and your money on the day which Yom Kippur occurs according to your calculation. In other words, Rabban Gamliel's Rosh Hashanah, now, this is an interesting wrinkle that we weren't aware of until now, but which Rosh Chodesh is being sanctified here? Tishrei. Notice how Rosh Hashanah is making a kind of surreptitious appearance. Okay, the Mishnah never uses the term Rosh Hashanah. We're actually talking not just about sanctifying a month, sanctifying a very significant month, sanctifying Rosh Hashanah. Now, whether the previous, okay, according to Rabbi Yeshua, Rosh Hashanah comes out a day later than it does according to Rabban Gamliel. So Rabban Gamliel says, well, this is presumably already on the second day of the month, okay, and Rabban Gamliel is saying to Rabbi Yeshua, in another 8 days is going to be Yom Kippur, according to my calculation. And in another 9 days is going to be Yom Kippur, according to your calculation. You will violate your Yom Kippur, okay, by coming before me, okay, with your staff and your money on that day. You're going to travel from one town to another, going to carry Vachadik materials with you. You're going to show that as far as you're concerned, your reckoning that that day of Yom Kippur was completely off. You have completely rescinded your view on that. Okay, now before we go further, let's reflect a little on why Rabban Gamliel is issuing this challenge to, or this demand to Rabbi Yoshua, not to the original one who challenged his ruling, who was Rabbi Dosa ben Harkinas. There's several answers. I think all of them are correct. Some of the answers are historical in nature. Rabbi Dosa ben Harkinas, we know historically, at the time of the high court in Yavne, Rabbi Dosa ben Harkinas was an old pensioner. Okay, he was much older than the other sages. He didn't actually normally participate in the deliberations and rulings of the court in Yavne, but he was a very venerable old man. Rabbi Yoshua, on the other hand, was a key player in the court in Yavne. He was much younger and he was a key player. Okay, and therefore, Rabban Gamliel figured two things. Number one, he's going to take a 95-year-old man and tell him, you're going to go on a long walk. That's going to backfire. It's going to boomerang. People are going to say, how could he do such a thing to this elder? I mean, you know, imagine doing something like that to a 95-year-old rabbi. You don't do things like that. Okay. Even if you think it's necessary. Number two, Rabbi Dosa ben Harkinas is not really a threat to Rabban Gamliel's authority because he's not a key player. Rabbi Yoshua is younger and he's a key player. So he's much more of a threat. Those are historical reasons that I think are probably both correct. But I think there's another answer that emerges from the language of the Mishnah itself, which is Rabbi Dosa ben Harkinas issued a logical challenge to Rabban Gamliel. And Rabban Gamliel didn't react to that. Rabban Gamliel does not forbid people from entertaining their own opinions or even from voicing their own opinions. Okay? What Rabban Gamliel objects to is when Rabbi Yoshua accepts the opinion because that gives it validity. And Rabban Gamliel says that can't be. Now, What this Mishnah, I think, is making very clear before we see the continuation, it's already making very clear what's at stake here. If it's crucially important to sanctify the right day, it is no less important that Am Yisrael observe one day and know that that day is reliable. If Am Yisrael observes Rabban Gamliel's day and then gets wind of the fact that Rabbi Yoshua disagreed and thought another day was Yom Kippur, that will undermine faith in the entire system. I want to use that to answer another question, okay? Not going to have time to like really work through this question. I'll just present it briefly. Rabban Gamliel could have decreed upon Rabbi Yoshua, you will absolutely observe my Yom Kippur. That way everyone will see that's the real Yom Kippur. Rabban Gamliel doesn't stop at that point. And I think there are clear indications from the continuation of the Mishnah that what Rabbi Yoshua actually planned to do was to observe 2 days of Yom Kippur. One day he was going to observe for social reasons. That was Rabban Gamliel's day. Because he doesn't want to separate himself from the society. Rabban Gamliel is the head of the court. He knows that the people are going to follow his opinion. He will observe that day as well. He'll come to Kol Nidre on Rabban Gamliel's Yom Kippur. He'll come to Ni'ilah on Rabban Gamliel's Yom Kippur. He'll fast all day. He'll He'll beat his breast through all the al-chet. He'll observe that day. He doesn't have a problem with that. What he wants to do is observe a second day. Why? Because he says Rabban Gamliel's day is the wrong day. So I'll observe one day for social reasons. I'll observe the next day because that's the right day. That's the day God wants us to observe Yom Kippur. I'm going to observe that day. Even if I'm the only one in all of Israel observing that day, I'm going to observe it. And Rabban Gamliel says to him, no, you won't. You will not observe that day. Why not? I think today, more than at any time in history, we understand why not. We all know what it means to keep a secret, right? Tell one person at a time, okay? We all know what it means, you know, for a politician to say something off the record, okay? So then it gets leaked this way or it gets leaked that way. Yeah, there are no secrets. If Rabbi Yoshua observes the day in secret, all you need is one neighbor to knock on his door in the middle of the day and see that he's in the middle of Al-Chait, okay? And that person will say to his neighbor, hey, what's this important rabbi doing? He obviously thinks that the day we observed yesterday wasn't the right day. Rabban Gamliel is not going to leave any opening for that. Am Yisrael observe one day and one day only. Okay, and that's why he is issuing this very harsh draconian decree. And therefore Rabbi Akiva went and found him distressed. Distressed because he's being prevented from observing the day that he thinks is the right day. Okay, so Rabbi Akiva said, I can learn from a verse that everything that Rabban Gamliel did is done. As it stated, these are the appointed seasons of Hashem, sacred convocations, which you shall proclaim at their appointed time. Okay, now, notice in the translation, it says here, in their season. If you look at the Hebrew, you'll see in the original Hebrew, it says, ben bismanan, ben shalo bismanan, the word bimoadam is left out. And instead of bimoadam, the Mishnah says, ben bismanan, ben shalo bismanan. Now, according to any estimation, bimoadam means at its appointed time. Bein bizmanam, bein shelo bizmanam means whether they got the time right or not. The exact opposite of what the pasuk says. Rabbi Akiva, and this is all too characteristic of Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva reads the pasuk, okay, completely against the grain, against the pshat. The pshat is, you have to observe the festivals at their appointed time. And Rabbi Akiva says, you observe the festivals, bein bizmanam bein shelo bizmanam. Ein li mo'adot ela elu. We have no mo'adot except for these. And here I think he's darshaning the word ele, ele mo'adei Hashem. What are these? What days are the important days? Rabbi Akiva is really darshaning the words, Mikra'ei kodesh asher tikra'u otam. The times that God wants you to observe are the times declared by the court, not the times declared in the heavens, but the times declared by the court. Those are the appointed times. Those are the days you should observe. And what Rabbi Akiva implicitly is saying to Rabbi Yoshua is there's no point in observing your day. Once the court declared the other day, that's the day. There is one and only one day. God himself said that. Elem Odeshem, these are my festivals. I have no other. I don't have a day up in heaven that's different from the day you proclaim down on earth. If the court proclaimed the day down on earth, that's the one and only day. It's a brilliant midrash. We wonder how he can say it against the simple pshat of the psukim. We'll come back to that point in just a few minutes, but it's a brilliant midrash. And how does Rabbi Yoshua respond to it? He doesn't say to Rabbi Akiva, no, you're wrong. On the other hand, he doesn't say to Rabbi Akiva, yes, you're right. Instead, Valo etzel Rabbi Dosa ben Harkinas. He then comes to Rabbi Dosa ben Harkinas. Remember the one who first proclaimed that Rabban Gamliel was mistaken. He comes to him. He's obviously saying, what should I do? You and I, we're thinking alike. What should I do here? Amar lo im ba ba'in anu ladun achar beit dino shel Rabban Gamliel. Okay, if we want to second guess the ruling of Rabban Gamliel, we must second guess the rulings of every court that has stood from the days of Moshe until now. Okay, and then he's got another interesting drasha to prove that the authority of the court doesn't depend upon how great the judges were. Depends upon, and he says, this is the language at the end, kol shlosha, okay, top line on your screen in the Hebrew, kol shlosha u'shlosha shamdu beit din al Yisrael. Every court of three that stands over Israel, okay, hareyu k'beit dino shel Moshe, it's as though Moshe himself spoke. Moshe and his court spoke. Okay? Why did Rabbi Yoshua need that second, need that second reassurance? What was bothering him? I think if we look closely, we'll see Rabbi Dosa is answering a different question than Rabbi Akiva answered. Rabbi Akiva's question was, can there be a discrepancy between the real Yom Kippur and the Yom Kippur that's observed by Am Yisrael? And his answer was, no, there cannot be a discrepancy. God himself proclaimed, my festivals are the ones observed by Israel. Why wasn't that enough for Rabbi Yoshua? I think we can see the answer from Rabbi Dosa's drasha. Rabbi Dosa doesn't address the same question Rabbi Akiva addressed. The question he addresses is not, what kind of authority? Is it a heavenly authority or a human authority that establishes sanctity? The question answered by Rabbi Dosa is, which human authority? Which human authority? Rabbi Yoshua is wondering, okay, Rabban Gamliel thinks one way and I think differently. Why should Rabban Gamliel decide and not I? Am I not as great as Rabban Gamliel? I think I am as great as Rabban Gamliel, and I'm right. In this case, I'm absolutely right. I'm absolutely convinced that I'm right. I think I'm absolutely as competent to decide these issues as Rabban Gamliel. Why should he decide and not I? And what's Rabbi Dosa's answer? The answer is in the words, Amdu Beit Din al Yisrael. Rabban Gamliel is recognized as the authority for Am Yisrael. And therefore, his word goes. You, however great you might be greater than Rabban Gamliel. Very possible, says Rabbi Dosa. In this particular instance, you're right. I happen to agree with you. However, you don't have his authority. In other words, who determines it? The one who has the authority. Authority is, in a sense, a kind of self-validating concept. And therefore, Natal Maklo Ma'utav Biadov Alach Liyavne Itzel Rabban Gamliel B'yom Shechal Yom HaKippurim Liyot B'cheshbono. So he then trudged to Yom Kippur, and I say trudged because I'm convinced he was not a happy camper. He went. Rabban Gamliel gave him a great greeting. Rabban Gamliel stood up and kissed him on his head. Come in peace, my teacher and my student, my teacher in wisdom. Interesting, Rabban Gamliel acknowledges that Rabbi Yoshua is a greater sage than he is. Rabbi Yoshua was not wrong to think that he's at least as competent as Rabban Gamliel in deciding questions of halacha. Rabban Gamliel acknowledges that. However, you are also my student because you accepted my statement. In other words, what is this story about? It's about the age-old question of truth versus authority. And the Mishnah comes down very firmly in on the side of authority. Authority overrides truth. And this becomes, this story is famous because it's often used as a model for how halachic authority works in general, not only in the matter of Kiddush HaChodesh, but for how authority works in general. Okay? Now, let's review once again what we've seen in the chapter. Okay, we started off with a continuation of the witnesses journeying on Shabbat. And we come back and wonder once again, why the chapter division? So we saw some reasons for this last week within the framework of the structure of chapter one. But we'll see additional reasons for it within the structure of chapter two. Okay, so we continue with that. We interrupt that discussion by talking about the lighting of the torches. Okay, we then come back to the witnesses. The witnesses are then examined. The court declares it. And then we have what seem to be appendices to the chapter. How did Rabban Gamliel examine the witnesses? And then these two stories about Rabban Gamliel in very puzzling and enigmatic and challenging ways, accepting witnesses who seem clearly to be false witnesses. And in the second case, this very powerful story of the confrontation between him and Rabbi Yoshua, in which Rabban Gamliel, in the end, reestablishes his authority and reestablishes the idea of how important authority is for the process of sanctifying the new moon and for halakha in general. Okay, so the chapter seems to be jumping back and forth quite a bit. Okay, now let's just take a look at the there's one final point that we should make here about the jumping of the chapter. Let's look at the first Mishnah of the next chapter. Ra'uhu Beitin v'chol Yisrael, Echgeroidin, we're still talking about the sanctification of the new moon. And then, what is the second Mishnah? Okay, look at the introduction in the English. The Mishnah begins to discuss the primary mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah. And the whole rest of the chapter is about Rosh Hashanah. What is this Mishnah doing in the third chapter? Same way that chapter one was a run-on chapter because it like ends in the middle and the content of chapter one juts out into chapter two. Chapter two juts out into chapter three. And the transition to the next subject of Shofar is not at the beginning of the chapter, but beforehand, right? So, but in the middle of the chapter, right? So starting in, and the subject of chapter two runs on into chapter one. So it's really very puzzling. The story about Rabbi Yoshua and Rabban Gamliel is a very powerful, dramatic end to chapter two, but it seems really out of place because the main drama of that story is about accepting the witnesses. We're still talking about accepting the witnesses. But if you go back to Mishnah Zayin, we already accepted the witnesses. Why are we jumping back to when can witnesses be accepted and when can they not be accepted? Right? Let's just get a bit of an overview of the structure of this chapter and then we'll begin to talk about some of the ideas. Okay, so we need share screen again, and let's get to. Okay, so in here is a color-coded version of this chapter. Okay, now just note a couple of things. First of all, when we diverge from Mishnah Aleph to Mishnah Bet, we jump once again from the witnesses to the messengers. Notice how similar these Mishnayot are. See the color coding: Barishona, Mishakilkalu, Hitzkinu. Right, it's the same pattern, and this seems to be something that not infrequently happens in the Mishnah. We saw it in chapter one with Mishnayot Gimel and Dalid. Okay. And that is the Mishnah is arranged associatively and not necessarily topically. Okay. I think that's a very partial explanation. And the color coding will give us an idea as to why it's only a partial explanation. look at Mishnah Dalet and Mishnah Hay. Mishnah Hay returns us to the main subject of the chapter. Okay, that's the courtyard where the witnesses came to. And notice how from Beit Baltin, Lo Zazu Misham, they would not budge from Beit Baltin until they saw the torches on the next mountaintop. And now look at the institution of Rabban Gamliel Barishona, Lo Hayu Zazin Misham Kol Hayom. They would not budge from there all day. So the Mishnah links up the end of this digression, okay, literally it links it up to the beginning of the next section. Okay? Now let's notice something else. Something else links the digression to the rest of the chapter. That's a key word that runs through the chapter. To see. Ro'eh. Ro'eh. Okay? Ben shenir abizmano. Ben shalonir abizmano. Vahen mar'eh. Ra'inu. Ra'inuhu. Ra'inuhu nir'ah. Ro'eh. Okay? You see how often this term... And it links up all of the sections of the chapter. It really runs all of the sections of the chapter together. And now let's look at what I think is the most crucial point in linking up the chapter, and that is the inclusio. Okay? First of all, there's a word that links the first two Mishnayot to the last two Mishnayot. The first Mishnah talks about accepting the witnesses. Are you mikablim? Okay. At first they would accept anyone. Then they decided to accept only those whom they recognized. The end of the chapter, Rabban Gamliel accepted the witnesses. That's what started the whole altercation, the whole confrontation between him and Rabbi Yoshua. And then, interestingly, at the end of the story, my student, because you accepted not my testimony, but my ruling. So notice how we've moved from accepting witnesses to accepting the ruling. That's the whole move in the whole chapter. The chapter opens with how important it is to have witnesses who can be accepted. And how does the chapter end? With witnesses who really are very problematic. It's very hard to accept them. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri rejects the first pair. Rabbi Dosa and Rabbi Yoshua reject the second pair. It's hard to accept these witnesses. And in the end, Rabbi Yoshua doesn't accept the witnesses. What does he accept? Rabban Gamliel's ruling. We have moved from accepting witnesses to accepting the ruling. Now,
Isn't that similar to the shift in Ro'eh from seeing to Ro'eh ani et varecha?
Excellent. We see the very same shift in the word from the physical seeing to the Ro'eh ani et varecha, which is the halachic ruling. Okay? So, and when you see that the linguistic structures of the chapter are leading in the same direction, that increases our confidence that this is something planned. It's something programmed into the Mishnah. Now let's just conclude for tonight we'll conclude with a second point, but let's note two further points. First of all, the connection between the beginning of the chapter and the end of the chapter is not only through the word lekabel and the interesting shift in meaning in that term. It's also from the fact that the chapter opens with two stories and closes with two stories. Two historical events at the beginning, two historical events at the end. The beginning, there are two historical events from the time when the court sat in Yerushalayim and the court had to handle challenges to the proper sanctification of the new moon. From where? Where did the challenges come from? First from the Minim, okay, some sectarian group, then from the Kutim, the Samaritans. In other words, the challenges came from outside. And how did the court in Yerushalayim address these challenges? They instituted changes in the procedure changes they didn't want to make, but that they felt were necessary in order to circumvent these challenges. So they basically neutralized the challenge. They said, these people cannot interfere with our proper sanctification of the new moon. That's how the court in Jerusalem handled challenges that came from the outside. And now look at the two stories at the end of the chapter. The two stories at the end of the chapter are, first, Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri says, Eidei Sheker Hein. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri is not a challenge from outside. He's a challenge from inside. He's a key player in the judicial system of Am Yisrael in the period of Yavne. We've jumped now from Second Temple times and Jerusalem to post-Second Temple times in Yavne. When they came to Yavne, Rabban Gamliel accepted them. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri didn't continue his challenge. And then we had the very dramatic confrontation again in Yavne. So now we're at the time of Yavne, and now the challenges are no longer coming from outside. Where are the challenges coming from now?
Inside.
From inside. So how does Rabban Gamliel confront these challenges? By making an institution and circumventing the challenges? No. What does he do to Rabbi Yoshua? He doesn't say to Rabbi Yoshua, okay, I'm throwing you out off of the high court, right? That's what the court in Jerusalem would have done. They said, you want to challenge our authority? Goodbye. We're not going to let you into our court anymore. You have nothing to say to us. What did Rabban Gamliel do with Rabbi Yoshua? He said to him, you have to demonstrate to the people that you accept my authority. Question, what if Rabbi Yoshua in the end would not have been persuaded? What if both Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Dosa had failed to persuade him? What would have happened? He wouldn't have gone. And then the people would have split. Some of the people would have said, no, we follow Rabban Gamliel. And other people would say, no, Rabbi Yoshua is a greater scholar. He's a greater sage. We're going to follow Rabbi Yoshua. Rabban Gamliel cannot solve this problem by fiat. He decrees something on Rabbi Yoshua, but he waits for Rabbi Yoshua to actually carry out the decree. If Rabbi Yoshua is not in the end persuaded that this is the way to go, it will all collapse. Another way of saying this is, one of the key messages of this chapter is that authority is a function of people accepting the authority. Okay? You can exercise authority if people recognize it. And that is exactly Rabbi Dosa's message in the end to Rabbi Yoshua. Said, why does Rabban Gamliel have authority and you don't? Because the people accept his authority. Okay? It's a circular idea. But that's the way it works. You can't get out of this circle. He has authority because people recognize the authority. And why then does Rabbi Yoshua in the end accede to Rabban Gamliel's authority? Because he recognizes that Rabban Gamliel has authority. He says, the people accept his authority, therefore I have no choice but to bow to his authority. I think he's wrong. I think I'm superior in wisdom. He even admits that I'm superior in wisdom, and nevertheless, I will accede to his authority, okay? Because once the people have accepted the authority, that's how it has to be. Okay, now...
question. Can we ask a question? Rabbi, at that time, that was by Cheney, they had already information about the calendar. So didn't Rabbi Gamliel know that the Edom are not honest?
Okay, that's an excellent question. There are some who see that there is actually a hint in the Mishnah to the fact that Rabban Gamliel knew the calculation of the reckoning, and that is in line 12, down at the bottom here, liot becheshbono, calculation. It's not altogether clear what calculation means. Does calculation here just mean reckoning based on whether or not the witnesses are acceptable, or some think based on his astronomical calculation. Okay. So it might be even indicated in the language of the Mishnah itself that they knew how to calculate it. Okay. But what does the calculation, how does that interweave with the whole procedure of witnesses sighting the moon and so on, is an excellent question, one that we don't have any time to go into right now. Okay, so we'll just suffice by saying the Mishnah makes it very clear that whether or not they knew how to calculate when the new moon appears, okay, that's not what they relied on in order to sanctify the new moon. It was crucially important to Chazal that it take place through witnesses, citing, judicial procedure, and so on. Okay, and perhaps we'll conclude for tonight with a question. Why? Why was that so crucially important to them? Okay, now we don't have time tonight to answer that question. Okay, but I'll put the question out. You have a week to think about it. And Bezrat Hashem, next week, we'll come back to examine that question. And what I think is very interesting is that I think from chapters 1 and 2, you come to one answer to that question. And when we look at chapter 3, remember the first Mishnah in chapter 3, it's still talking about sanctification of the new moon. I think part of the reason that Mishnah is there, because it's actually offering us or suggesting to us a different answer to that same question. Okay, so we're closing with the question, why is this process so crucially important? But I think what we have seen tonight will give us a sense that this chapter, like chapter 1, despite all of the glitches that seem to occur as you read through the chapter, it's very carefully structured. And there's a reason why we open not only with one story about the witnesses, but with a second story about the messengers and the beacons. And we conclude also with two stories that seem again to be out of place, because we already finished with when do we accept witnesses and what do we do when we accept witnesses. And now we're back to when can you accept the witnesses. But the two stories at the end of the chapter frame the chapter together with the first two stories to give us some very important messages, right? Not messengers, very important messages about what Chazal see is crucially important in Kiddush HaChodesh. Okay? The proper functioning of the society is crucially important. How does the society function? Well, in Yerushalayim, it functioned in one way, and in Yavne, it seems to function somewhat differently. The challenges in Yerushalayim were one kind of challenge. The challenges in Yavne were another kind of challenge. And all these challenges have to be properly addressed in order for the society to function in such a way as to properly sanctify the new moon and thereby sanctify festivals, including most prominently here, Yom Kippur. Okay? So why is that the procedure is our question. We will close with that and Bezrat Hashem pick up with that next week. Any further questions, I'll be happy.
I have a question here. Is it possible... Yes. Is it possible that the opinion of Rabbi Yehoshua is analogous to his opinion of Lo Bashamayim Hi, that the dependence on Edim is the dependence of Lo Bashamayim Hi, even if Rabban Gamliel knew Bashamayim what the date was, it's Lo Bashamayim Hi. It depends on Edim, and we're dealing.
Okay, you're right in comparing the two stories, but if anything, the two stories seem to be moving in opposite directions. Because Rabbi Yehoshua in our story seems to be saying it is Bashamayim. Okay? The real day is the day that was declared up in heaven. I don't care what the court declared. Court can declare whatever day they like. That's not the real
thing. Rabbi Yehoshua accepts.
In the end, right. At the end of the story, he does accept it. Okay? But that's, you know, when he, in the end, knuckles under to Rabban Gamliel's authority, but at least the position.
Victory, but then the two stories seem to me very analogous. And I think Hashamayim is the basis of the dependence on the Edim.
Okay. Now, the assumption behind that would be that the story of Tanurosh Alachnai is an afterlude to our story. It's only after Rabbi Yoshua has finally accepted Rabban Gamliel's authority and said, whatever happens in the heavens doesn't determine anything. It's only after that point that Rabbi Yoshua is able to stand up to Rabbi Eli, to the bat kol of Rabbi Eliezer and say, Lo b'shamayim.
I think it's possible that the very word tanur is a word play with tana. It's a question of whether the tana was broken by tanur.
Okay, maybe. I don't know. Okay, thank you all, and Erev Tov.
Good night.
Thank you so much.